2020census.gov. If you need help, you can contact United Way by calling 211.
Every Tuesday from 6 to 6:30 p.m., Radioactive Magazine, a locally produced public affairs program, spotlights individuals and organizations in our community that deal with ideas and issues of social and political significance, such as climate change, racial and gender inequality, pay inequity, and much, much more. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesdays, 6 to 6:30 p.m., right here on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
This is Phil Donahue, and you're listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Welcome to Jaws of Justice Radio on 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. It's Monday morning. My name is Terry. This morning, host Elise Max talks about the issue of local control of the police department with John Chasnoff of the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression, CAPCAR, a St. Louis-based organization which aims to end police crimes and abuse. In the wake of the shootings of Ryan Stokes and Cameron Lamb, the state's responsibility for accountability and oversight of the KCPD has been called into question. In February 2020, Kansas City City Council adopted a resolution that formed a public safety committee appointed by the mayor to look at the benefits and downfalls of local control of the Kansas City Police Department. Our show today will focus on the movement for local control. After the calendar, in the second half of our hour, host Margot Patterson speaks to Christine Hammond, founder and executive director for the Prosecutor Center for Excellence, PCE. PCE was established in 2016. The mission of PCE is to create a better justice system by identifying, evaluating, and implementing best practices and innovations for modern prosecutors. Listen to learn their thoughts on how excellent prosecutors will improve our criminal justice system. There are three stages to the criminal justice system: the past, the present, and the future. The only thing we cannot change is the past. We will air the 420 drug war news at the end of our program. Please stay tuned. Let's listen now to Elise Max and John Chasnoff.
Good morning. My name is Elise Max. I am here in the studio this morning with John Chasnoff from the Coalition Against Police Crimes and Repression. We are going to focus this morning on the movement in Kansas City and the lessons learned from St. Louis to gain local control of the police department. So, John, thank you so much.
I'm excited to be here. Thank you.
This morning and being in Kansas City today. So just to start out, can you just tell me a little bit about CAPCAR and a little bit about the work you do in St. Louis?
Sure. So CAPCAR is an organization that's been around since 1983, and the group focuses on police accountability issues. That involves helping victims of police misconduct and also working systemically to change the system. So CAPCAR did a long campaign to get a civilian oversight board in St. Louis and also the campaign for local control, which we got in St. Louis in 2013.
That's exciting. So, you know, Kansas City has been in the struggle for local control for a little while. I would be curious to know what you know about the history of local control in Missouri.
Well, so this issue goes way back into the 19th century, and it's an interesting history. I actually looked up the St. Louis Ordinance that reorganized the police department in 1856, and it was really typical of what was happening around the country, which was that the mayors appointed individual police officers at that point, and it was really a patronage position. So naturally, people who were appointed by the mayor were interested in getting that mayor reelected. The police were overly involved in influencing outcomes of elections, and it was a fairly corrupt system. And so really all across the country, there was a move towards state control of the police. And the idea was to get the politics out of policing and have independent police departments that were able to provide equal protection under the law. That was the idea. But it really didn't last long as a reform because it really only moved the politics from the city to the state level. And cities went back to local control, most of them in the 19th century. Kansas City and St. Louis as recently as 2012, were the only two cities left in the country that still had state control. Kansas City had tried an experiment with local control in the early 20th century, but it was the Pendergast era, and the corruption in politics forced people to step in and move it back to state control. But St. Louis got local control in 2013. That just leaves Kansas City as the only city in the country that still doesn't control its own police department.
Wow. That's an anomaly, and that's shows us the work ahead that we need to do. So when people talk about gaining local control, what are some of the benefits? Why would what would be the argument to convince Kansas Cityans to push forward with this campaign?
Well, the idea behind local control is that government works best when it's closest to the people. And when it comes to policing, what communities want is different in every different part of the country or different parts of the state. And so in order to have a police department that is responsive to local concerns and local interests, police in the way that the community wants to be policed, you really need to have the governance of the police department as close to the people as possible.
So right now in Kansas City, we have a commission that includes the mayor. It's five people, but it's appointed by the governor.
Right.
So the mayor is the only, not necessarily, but would be the only person on our city council that could have a voice on this commission. So talk to me about the steps that St. Louis took while they were gaining, while they were fighting for local control. What kind of campaigns, what was successful and what didn't work? Mm-hmm.
Well, one of the things that we did early on was to have a referendum in the city to see if the community really wanted local control and if this was something that St. Louis wanted to fight for. And the outcome of that referendum was strongly in favor of local control. And so that was a good first step, I think, to really bring this issue to the community itself and see what the response was going to be. One of the difficulties of mounting a campaign like this is that the city can't decide for itself to take back control of its police department. The police department is set up by state statute, and so it takes a change to that state statute to gain local control. And it's not surprising it's very difficult to convince politicians to give up power. And so that was one of the real obstacles in this campaign. We would go up to Jeff City with policing issues. And what we found was nobody up there really cared about policing in St. Louis. Somebody from Joplin, Missouri, or, you know, somebody from Joplin, Missouri has a constituency that knows nothing and cares nothing about policing in St. Louis. And so there's no accountability for that politician. And it was a vote that they could then trade for something they really wanted. Mm-hmm. And so that was the system that was operating in Jefferson City. And that was a perk and a power that it was difficult to convince politicians to give up.
So the citywide referendum, was that something that the Alder people, which is similar to our city council, requested so they could gauge public opinion?
Yes, exactly. We had some allies on the city council, the Board of Aldermen in St. Louis, and they're able to put issues on the ballot. So they put that one on there as a non-binding referendum.
As a non-binding referendum. Uh-huh. Okay. So in Kansas City, just so our listeners are aware, the city council did pass a resolution that was for the mayor to appoint a public safety board that would look at the benefits and the downfalls of local control. But it's also been tasked to look at what's been successful in curtailing gun violence as well. Mm-hmm. So not really as pointed and specific as Melissa Robinson, our city council person, started out with a resolution that was to interview stakeholders to come back with the benefits and downfalls of local control. And it seems that, you know, at being the last city to gain local control, we could learn a lot of lessons about the benefits and downfalls from other places like St. Louis.
Right.
So, you know, we're glad that there's talk in the city council, but we also are looking for ideas and ways that might speed up the process, because
right.
the study would take a minute, and I think the referendum is a good way to gauge public support, because I think that's what the council wants to know is, you know, how do the public supporters feel as the taxpayers, how are we going to hold our police accountable? Mm-hmm. It's just such a huge question. Right. So that's an interesting process. So when the legislation passed to re-give control to St. Louis, what happened with Kansas City? Why didn't control go back to all of the cities? Was it specific to St. Louis, or was there any mention of Kansas City during that process?
So we had bills in Jefferson City to create local control starting in 2008 and didn't gain local control until 2012. Wow. So it was a multi-year process. And at the time, the original bill that we put forward would have given local control to both St. Louis and Kansas City. But the Kansas City legislators at the time were opposed to the concept. They were comfortable with the system as it was. And so they asked to have Kansas City taken off that bill. That was we didn't want to force something on Kansas City if they didn't want it. There wasn't a strong voice coming from the community one way or another, and so we listened to the political representatives and took Kansas City off that bill.
Gotcha. Do you remember the reasoning or why they weren't supportive of taking back local control?
They just said, we're happy with the way things are now. It's all working fine in Kansas City.
Yeah, it's all working fine. Okay. And so, unfortunately, sometimes it takes a tragedy, a couple tragedies, for people to start questioning whether things are working fine.
And politicians don't always know how it's working unless people organize and stand up and make their voice be heard. And so I'm excited that there is that kind of organizing happening here in Kansas City.
Yeah. So CAPCAR was a leader in this process. What kind of happened? Did a coalition form in support of local control? Was one organization taking the lead? How did the momentum kind of build?
Well, so CAPCAR really was the organization that pushed this issue for a long time. And we just took it to the community. That's our organizing philosophy. And so we did a lot of going to neighborhood associations and building support, educating the community about the pluses of local control. And originally, the mayor was not on board with the idea. Francis Slay was the mayor at the time, had been in office for a while, and really hadn't taken a stand one way or another. But we, as we built momentum, we took the issue to the mayor and convinced him that this was an issue that could be won, and he got on board. So that gave us the political support and political clout in Jeff City that we needed to move things.
So then you had use of the older people, and the mayor had their own lobbyists to be pushing
the issues. Exactly.
Okay. Well, that makes a lot of sense.
The other thing that happened that really pushed it forward was that the police association in St. Louis was opposed to the idea. Mm-hmm. The main issue for them was that their pension was controlled by the state, and frankly, they said it explicitly, they didn't trust the mayor to handle their pension money. And so that was really their concern. So we made it clear in the legislation that the pension for police would stay under state control. That took a lot of the, anti-local control, pressure off of us. And the other thing that really cinched the deal with the police association was that they wanted to unionize. And the mayor made a deal with them that they could have a union if they backed off on local control. After that, there really was no opposition coming from St. Louis.
Okay. All right. So after local control passed, I'm curious as to what were some of the challenges, the immediate challenges that were faced. And I guess I'll back up just a minute. What was passed by the legislature, was it similar to what initially was being pushed? Did you get what you wanted in it as far as accountability?
Right. There were a lot of bumps along the road. The legislation changed a lot as it, as we went through the 4 or 5 years to get this done. And in the end, we came within inches of getting it passed on the state level and couldn't get it through. The mayor decided at that point that he wanted to do a statewide ballot initiative and pass it that way instead of trying to work through the legislature. And so they put together a ballot initiative, and which would require then a vote of the whole state to vote on whether St. Louis should have local control. Along the way, they put in a provision into that ballot initiative that we were opposed to. It explicitly put any accountability for policing under the control of our Civil Service Commission. And we thought that language precluded having a civilian oversight board. So we were strongly opposed to that. We got everyone to agree that that's not what the language said. We still thought that's what it said, but we got our opponents to say, no, you can have a civilian oversight board. And so shortly after we got local control, we also got the Civilian Oversight Board in St. Louis.
That's great. So talk a little bit about the Civilian Oversight Board. I guess, what is its intent? And I'm curious on how it is actually functioning in St. Louis. Is it appointed? Is it elected? Let us know about that.
Yeah. So Civilian Oversight Board, the idea behind that is to open up the kind of fortress mentality of the police department, the lack of transparency, to open that up to civilian input. And so the Civilian Oversight Board in St. Louis has two main functions. It gets complaints from the community if there's alleged misconduct by the police. And it reviews the internal affairs investigation and makes its own decisions then about whether or not there was misconduct in a given case. If they're unhappy with the internal affairs, they can do their own independent investigation. So that's one of the, and then they make a recommendation to the chief on discipline regarding that incident. So that's one of its major functions. The second major function is to look at policies and procedures and operations of the police department and make broad policy recommendations. So if they think there needs to be a change in the standard for officer-involved shootings, or how those shootings are investigated, or any policies within the police department that they think are threatening the safety of the community or the police officers, they can make policy recommendations. We think that's a really important power for civilian oversight because it allows them not to just hold individual officers accountable, but to change the whole culture of the police department through policy changes.
That's great. And the people that sit on the oversight board, how do they get that position?
So that was a really a controversial issue when we were trying to pass this legislation. We thought that a majority of the members should be elected.
Okay.
We thought that was a basic democratic principle, but it was the most controversial part of our legislation. In the end, we got a back and forth system between the Board of Alders and the mayor. So community members can recommend to alder persons who they think should sit on the board. The aldermen pass those recommendations on to the mayor. The mayor from that pool nominates seven people, and then the Board of Alders approves or disapproves of those seven choices.
Okay.
And along the way, there's a required public hearing as well. So there's a chance for public input both at the beginning of the process and during the final approval process.
That is a complicated method, but
right.
I mean, how do you feel it's been working? I can see that it's been set up to ensure there is some input from the public.
Right.
Has it been successful? Getting the people that are most invested or most affected by police conduct and so forth to sit on this board?
It's been partially successful, I'd say. You know, everybody has an interest, and there are a lot of different interest groups who want to see members on the board. So we never thought that CAPCAR would get to pick seven members and that's who would be on the board. That's not how it works.
Mm-hmm.
But there is, I think, it's the members are also set up so they represent geographic parts of the city.
Okay.
So not everybody, you can't have all seven members coming from one part of the community. It's spread out across the whole city. And so that ensures some diversity and diverse points of view. And that's worked fairly successfully. There's also we built in staff for the Civilian Oversight Board. So it's not just a board that meets once a month. They have full-time investigators and an executive director, and that staff has been very dynamic in pushing these issues forward.
Wow. So there is a fiscal note certainly attached to creating this review board, which we're grateful that we can have some back and forth about, you know, what that could potentially look like for Kansas City. What is, can you off the top of your head think of a success the Civilian Review Board has brought forward in St. Louis?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest successes is really behind the scenes, but it makes a difference. So internal affairs tended to take a somewhat antagonistic stance when it came to people filing complaints and would often discourage people from filing the complaint or just not be user-friendly. So people can now file complaints with the Oversight Board instead of with Internal Affairs. So there's a much more user-friendly interface at the beginning. And then they've also been able to affect internal affairs to kind of back off from their antagonistic approach themselves when they're doing interviews. The Oversight Board sits in on any internal affairs interviews with civilians, and so they've been able to see how that operates and change that part of the experience for community people.
That's very, very powerful. Mm-hmm. That creates a safer community for everyone when you are inviting and welcoming for complaints and feedbacks. Mm-hmm. So, okay, now to the second part of my question. Mm-hmm. Once this passed in the package that passed, what were some of the immediate challenges? And I'll just frame this by saying there was recently a hearing with our city council people, and they would say, you know, we've seen local control happen in St. Louis, and that gives us pause for Kansas City to move forward. Mm-hmm. So I'm curious, you know, what do you think they're talking about? What are the challenges that you've learned from that we need to keep in mind as we move forward?
Well, there have been some challenges. There's also been some big successes, and there's much more to be done, which we can do because we have local control. So I think overall it's been a really good move.
Yeah.
One of the challenges is, so once you have local control, the city has to make some determination of how the governance structure should work. So there are questions like, should the police department be under the Department of Public Safety, or should it be its own department? Or a question like, should the mayor be able to just appoint a police chief, or should the mayor nominate a police chief and then that's approved by the city council? There are lots of choices like that that need to be determined. One of the things that tied our hands was that written into the St. Louis Charter from, we never found the date, but from way back when, they said if we ever got local control, the police department would be under the Director of Public Safety. Mm-hmm. So that was predetermined for us and would take a charter change. That's not how we would have set it up, but we were kind of stuck with that, at least for the time being. But one of the, it takes some time. We're still, even though we're 6 or 7 years in, it's still very early in the process. We had 150 years of state control. And so the legislature is figuring out what's its role as a check and balance on the executive branch when it comes to policing. And that's taken some time to figure out. So, for instance, should the Board of Aldermen write policy for the police department, or should the police department write the policy and then there's some oversight by the aldermen in terms of, and that oversight could just be in terms of transparency and hearings, mm-hmm. or it could be that the Board of Alders gets to approve a policy once it's written. Those are the types of decisions that St. Louis is still kind of tentatively figuring out. But one of the big successes we had was the state statute said that police chiefs had to come from within the department, and they were picked by the Board of Police Commissioners. It was kind of like how they pick a pope. They'd all go into some room, and when they had a decision, they'd come out and tell us who the next police chief was. With local control, we were able to open up the process. When we wanted to pick a new police chief, we had a months-long process of community input and information gathering by the mayor's office on who should, how the search should happen. Should it be a national search, which it was for the first time, and then lots of community input. A commission was set up to kind of run this process. A civilian commission. So we were able to open up the police chief process, search process, to to get much more input from the community, and I think that was a big step forward.
Yeah, I think that's huge. Well, we're running out of time, and this is such a wonderful conversation. How can people get in touch with you or learn more about what happened in St. Louis and CAPCAR?
Yeah, well, I'd love to hear from anybody who has questions or concerns or just wants more information. Our email address is CAPCAR, that's CAPCR 2050@gmail.com, and that's probably the best way to reach us.
Great. And then also, will you share with our listeners, or I can share with our listeners, there'll be an event this evening that is co-hosted by the KC Equity and Justice Coalition, which is the ACLU and several other organizations, where John will be at the Bluford Library at 6 p.m. For some discussion and questions if you want to catch up with this conversation some more this evening.
Yes, I'm excited to hear from people in Kansas City, so come. I'd love to talk about this with everyone tonight. I'm looking forward to that.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today, and thank you for listening to KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
Support for KKFI provided by the Carlson Center at Johnson County Community College, presenting Winterlude with the Nate Nall Quintet. Nate Nall performs regularly with the Project H, Chris Hazleton Quartet, the Marcus Lewis Big Band, and more. Now fronting his own quintet and playing his own compositions and arrangements. Sunday, March 15th at 7 p.m. in the Polsky Theater. Details at jccc.edu/Carlson Center.
Ebony's Bones is a kitchen table conversation that explores the souls of Black folk as we decolonize and question everything that we've been told to believe. Tune in this Thursday, March 12th at 7 p.m. and have a seat at the table.
Pacifica Radio Archives, chronicling political, cultural, media, and artistic news, is considered to be one of the oldest and most important audio collections in the world by historians. PRA includes documentaries, databases, drama, poetry, commentaries, and radio arts. And you can listen to it every week, Wednesdays at 5 a.m., right here on KKFI.
Now the calendar for the week of March 9th. Corey's Network will have their weekly meeting with the Survivors Workshop from 6 to 8 p.m. at the Church of the Four Corners, the City House, 14300 East U.S. Highway 40, Independence, Missouri. The church is east of the Hy-Vee on 40 Highway. Corey's Network asks us to please join their weekly meetings to learn how to deal with grief, the media, investigation, court, and moving forward after a homicide has occurred. Check their website, coreysnetwork.org, or phone 816-866-7868. Let's Get Local Control of Kansas City Police Department will be 6 p.m. Monday, March 9th, at the Bluford branch of the Kansas City, Missouri Public Library, 3050 Prospect Avenue, Kansas City, Missouri. Do you know that Kansas City has the only police department in the entire country that's not under local control? This means Kansas City residents don't have a say in the police annual budget, which is about $270 million taxpayer dollars, sponsored by the Kansas City Equity and Justice Coalition. Also Monday, March 9th, your Fellow Americans documentary and discussion series is 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Central Public Library, 14 West 10th, Kansas City, Missouri. During this series, we ponder the question, who are your fellow Americans, and encourage discussion of the sensitive subjects of racism, prejudice, and immigration in calm conversation. There will be a phone bank for a safe and welcoming Wyandotte on Monday, March 9th from 5 to 8 p.m. at Grandview Park Presbyterian Church, 1613 Wilson Boulevard, Kansas City, Kansas, sponsored by Moore Squared. Crown and Glory, Understanding the Crown Act and Hair Discrimination, will be Monday, March 9th from 1 to 2 p.m. at Purple Label Barbershop, 11934 West 119th Street, Overland Park. The purpose of this event is to raise awareness of a law that ensures protection against discrimination based on hairstyles by extending statutory protection to hair texture and styles. Go to Eventbrite to register. Moms Demand Action Kansas, Johnson County Monthly Meeting, will be Thursday, March 12th from 6:30 to 8 p.m. at the Shawnee Mission Unitarian Universalist Church, 9400 Flum Road, Lenexa. Go to everytown.org to RSVP. Part 2, Killed by Police, It Can Happen to You, will be Thursday, March 12th, 6 p.m. at the Watkins Cultural Heritage Center, 3700 Blue Parkway, Kansas City, Missouri. You can learn more about police shootings in Kansas City from national and local attorneys who represent victims of KCPD. Mothers of incarcerated sons and daughters will have their monthly meeting Saturday, March 14th from noon to 2 p.m. at the Waldo Branch Library, 201 East 75th Street, Kansas City, Missouri. If you have a loved one who's incarcerated and need advice and support, MISD has members that may be able to help. Moms Demand Action Missouri, Kansas City meeting will be Sunday, March 15th from 1:30 to 2:30 p.m. at 7077 North Elmwood, Kansas City, Missouri. RSVP at everytown.org. My name is Terry, reminding you that these events and more can be found on the Jaws of Justice radio page on the KKFI website, kkfi.org, as well as the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. We want to thank all our volunteers today.
I'm Margo Patterson, and this is the Jaws of Justice. My guest today is Christine Hammond, the founder and executive director of the Prosecutor Center for Excellence. It's a nonprofit that works to improve the criminal justice system by identifying, evaluating, and implementing best practices for prosecutors. Ms. Hammond worked for many years in the Manhattan District Attorney's Office in New York City, where, among other roles, she served as Executive Assistant District Attorney to District Attorney Robert Morgenthau. She is chair of New York State's Best Practices Committee for Prosecutors and serves on the board of the ABA Criminal Justice Council. She has won many awards, including New York State's Best Prosecutor of the Year Award in 2013. She joins us by phone to talk to us about the work of the Prosecutor Center for Excellence. Christine Hammond, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Margo. Good morning.
Well, let's start by talking about what led you to establish the Prosecutor's Center for Excellence in 2016.
Well, it goes back a little to 2009 when I was asked to chair the Best Practices Committee for New York State's prosecutors. And that was in response to our understanding that wrongful convictions could occur. And as we were thinking about that, the sort of obvious answer to preventing wrongful convictions is to get it right the first time. And prosecutors have that responsibility to get it right the first time. So we formed this committee statewide amongst prosecutors to have that discussion about how could we improve our practices so we make sure that our convictions are accurate, based on reliable evidence, and just. From there, I got a fellowship at the Bureau of Justice Assistance, which is part of the Department of Justice, where I asked them, and they agreed, they took me on, whether I could bring that idea to prosecutors around the country, which I then did. I packed my suitcase and traveled to 30, 35 states speaking to prosecutors about our responsibilities to get things right the first time. And it went so well that when that fellowship was over, I formed Prosecutor Center for Excellence.
Well, I was interested to learn that while New York State was the first state in the nation to have a best practices committee for prosecutors, Missouri was the second. I understand the value of having such committees to establish standards, but given that they can only make recommendations, but as far as I understand, have no power to see that these recommendations are followed, can such committees really be effective in reforming what prosecutors do?
I think they can, and yes, I just want to give a shout out to Eric Zond, who is the district attorney of Platte County, Missouri. He was the first chair of the second best practices committee in the country, which was established in Missouri. And solutions to problems come in many different forms. Legislation is one, but internal evaluation and recommendations is another. So I think when we are faced with problems in any profession, we should go at it in as many ways as possible. And having buy-in and understanding from within will make change even more attainable. And that's what a best practices committee does.
Well, it seems like the Prosecutor Center is involved in a wide range of issues involved in criminal justice reform. Can you give us a sense of sort of the gamut of issues and also the range of services the center offers?
Yes. So, as I said, we started out on sort of looking at how we can prevent wrongful convictions, and that went to many procedural matters within criminal justice, such as identification procedures and taking statements and so forth. So that was one. When I think all of us gained a realization after the Michael Brown shooting in Ferguson, we really got to understand as prosecutors that there was a big gap between our work and our communities, and that should not be. Prosecutors serve their communities and should be engaged with their communities. And so my work has evolved to working on coming up with various ways that prosecutors can help their communities, work with them in any number of different ways. So that is a second area that we've been working on. A more recent one is we are now doing assessments of DA's offices where we're asked by the prosecutor to come in into their office and study what's going on to provide them with ideas, best practices, innovations, efficiencies, because often the elected prosecutor and everyone in the office is so busy they don't have time to sit back and think those kinds of thoughts. So we're actually in the middle of doing an assessment in St. Francis County, Missouri, which is a small DA's office, and we've been working there. They have a tremendous amount of work that they're struggling to keep up with, and we're assisting them there.
I'm wondering, what are some of the most common problems you see when you do these assessments of prosecutors' offices?
I think the biggest problem is caseload. They have so many cases. One prosecutor could have 200 or 300 cases. And if you think about the many issues that need to be resolved and looked at and evaluated, that's difficult when you have that many cases.
And how receptive or responsive do you find prosecutors and their staff are to criticisms or to advice?
They've been amazingly open. I find as I do the assessments, they're grateful for any help they can get. And usually by the time I've written my final report, three-quarters of our recommendations are already being implemented. So I've had no resistance at all. Just, you know, thanks for coming. Wish you had come a year ago kind of thing. So, no, it's been very encouraging.
Well, that's wonderful to hear. Prosecutors have come in, it seems, in recent years for a much greater degree of public scrutiny and public criticism. And many people think that prosecutors just have too much power. What's your response to that sentiment? And then also, if you could talk about how is it that prosecutors became the most influential actors in the criminal justice system? Did they always have such power, or has it been ceded to them over the years? And if so, how did that come about?
So you'll have to remind me, because I think there were about four or five questions
there. Were.
There. Let me try and sort of unpack some of it. Prosecutors are there because someone has to make a decision about what to charge. So whether you call them prosecutors or something else, there will always have to be someone who decides what to charge. And what the public may not know is the police come to prosecutors with an arrest, and prosecutors, as I said, have to decide what to do with it. Prosecutors are very far from a rubber stamp. I know in the office I used to work in, the Manhattan DA's office, we only charged about 40% of the felony charges brought to us by the police. And that could, the police can get kind of annoyed with us, and there's sort of more annoyance going on there than I think people realize. But that's the role of the prosecutor, to determine whether the law, the evidence meets the statutory requirements, number one, and number two, whether it's just to bring the charge, and number three, what is a good outcome? And one of the things that has evolved over the last several decades, which I think is a wonderful pattern, is the amount of diversion, treatment, alternative sentencing, restorative justice, all kinds of ways to resolve a case that didn't exist 30 years ago, but exists now and is growing. And that's a role that the prosecutors can play. So even if it's clear that someone has committed a crime, there are now many more options for how to resolve that case and resolve it in a way that hopefully will benefit the person that's arrested so they never come back again. Our goal is never to see that person again if we can.
And the many more options that now exist, diversion programs, et cetera, has that come about because of pressure from the public, because of criminal justice reform groups? How did that evolve?
Well, it's been around for a very long time. So many of these concepts have been around before it was a big sort of hot topic as it is now. But I do think the reform movement has put wind in the sails of these programs, which is only good. I think it's waking people up who may not have been paying much attention to these kinds of programs. So I think it's accelerating the progress of these proactively beneficial programs, which I think is a very good thing.
Well, I'd like to ask a couple of questions about technology and how that is affecting prosecutors. One question is simply about body-worn cameras by the police. What's been the impact of body cameras on police behavior, on prosecutions, on wrongful convictions?
So body-worn cameras are a tremendous addition to the criminal justice system. From a prosecutor's perspective, the value we see of body-worn cameras is it provides evidence. It provides evidence for us to evaluate a case to make sure that there isn't a wrongful conviction. So it's really helpful. So it's very positive. The downside, however, is that body-worn cameras, as well as all the other technical, digital, internet evidence that we are receiving, is overwhelming us. So you can imagine in, let's say, a typical driving while intoxicated stop. In the old days, the officer would write a series of reports, hand it to the DA. The DA would scan through them, look at the various breathalyzer, and then make a decision. Now, there may be two or three or even four officers who respond to that driving while intoxicated scene, all of whom who are wearing a body-worn camera, and they may very well be running that camera for over an hour each. So now we have to look at hours and hours of body-worn camera footage, when in the past we would have reviewed that case in a matter of minutes.
And so that, do you feel, slows down the work of prosecutors even more?
It adds to the burden of their work, yes. And yes, it does. As does viewing surveillance videos or all that kind of stuff that we all, you know, we're a technological world now. So prosecutors have to get in that game as well.
Well, let me ask you more about surveillance. But first, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking to Christine Hammond, Executive Director of the Prosecutor Center for Excellence. Christine, let's talk a little bit more about mass surveillance and, in particular, facial recognition technology. You wrote an article for the American Bar Association, which is how I first learned about the Prosecutor Center for Excellence, about facial recognition technology. And you mentioned that you thought soon you expected to see prosecutors introducing facial recognition technology as evidence into court. A lot of people have concerns about facial recognition technology being used for mass surveillance of all American citizens. What's your concerns about this technology, and do you see a struggle emerging between civil libertarians who would like, some of them, to completely ban all facial recognition technology and prosecutors?
So I think as a society, we're in a little bit of an epic struggle between technology and privacy, and it has yet to be resolved. And facial recognition is one of those issues. So on one hand, facial recognition can have tremendous benefits. It can, and of course you want to make sure that it's accurate, and there has been some questions about its accuracy, but I'm fairly confident that it eventually will get pretty accurate. It's already quite accurate when you look at Facebook and so forth. But benefits of facial recognition will be that you can look for, you know, let's say there's an Alzheimer's patient who's wandering around and the police can't be everywhere, but you could use it to try and find someone, or a terrorist is on the loose and you can use it to try and find someone where the police can't be everywhere. Someone is caught on a neighborhood video and you want to know who it is. So there are benefits where you can find lost people, you could stop terroristic acts, you can identify criminals. So that's a benefit. The downside, as you say, is we're not a society that particularly likes to have everybody watching us, and that's an important concern that needs to be resolved. And I think one of the downsides of this technology is there's been insufficient conversation with communities about how and when facial recognition should be used. So, for example, you mentioned its introduction in court, and I don't necessarily advocate its introduction in court. I don't know that it's reliable enough for that yet, but it could provide a lead to the police in an important case. And I would certainly advocate that if it provides a lead that sends the police to a person, that other corroborating evidence would be needed in order to make sure that you do have the right person. But in cases of public safety, I think it's important that officers have a lead and that they can use it. But I certainly don't advocate facial recognition being sort of a slam dunk in court. As you probably know, eyewitness identification has come under a lot of scrutiny, and so the same should be a facial recognition. But I do think it would be unfortunate to throw it out entirely because it does have benefits. It should just be used ethically and responsibly and with appropriate limitations.
Well, let's talk about eyewitness identification, because I believe the center has addressed some things, some of the flaws in eyewitness identification, and says there are some things that can be done to improve it. What are some of the steps that can be taken to improve the accuracy of eyewitness identification, or do you think it should be kind of thrown out altogether?
No, again, as with facial recognition, I don't think it should be thrown out altogether. As human beings, we are capable of making identifications of others, so I certainly don't think it should be thrown out altogether. But a person's identification should be treated with care so that when the police conduct an identification procedure, and that's usually done by showing a series of photographs to a person, that should be done in a fair way. So there's no clues given to the witness as to who they should pick. And there are many ways to ensure that the process is fair and that the cops do not in any way influence the witness's decision. That's the key. Because we have seen decades ago that there were wrongful convictions, and it turned out that the witness actually was never really certain about the ID. They said, I'm not really sure, but everybody ran with it as if it was an ID, and that's not appropriate. So there are relatively simple, easy-to-use procedures that can make sure that the ID is fair. And the good news is, I would say that kind of those kinds of procedures have been adopted by police departments all over the country. That process has been ongoing now for, I would say, we were working on it in 2009, and I've seen it all over the country. So I think police have come to understand that they need to conduct these identification procedures appropriately and fairly.
Witness intimidation is among the topics that the Prosecutor's Center for Excellence addresses. Talk to us about what steps are being taken to try to diminish witness intimidation and encourage witnesses to step forward.
Yes, I think this is a big topic. I think particularly in violent crime cases in vulnerable communities, there's an understandable concern for witnesses to come forward to testify. For example, testifying against a gang member who may live next to you is understandably really difficult. And yet, we need these witnesses in order to keep communities safe. So there are a number of steps that have to be taken. I think the very first step is, going back to something we discussed earlier, is for prosecutors to have a robust and meaningful relationship with their communities so that the communities trust the prosecutor to come in and tell them what had happened so that we can try and keep their communities safe. So that's number one. But the second step is to improve our coordination of protecting and helping witnesses from the moment we meet them, which would be at the crime scene, all the way through trial. And prosecutors do have victim witness advocates in their offices that can provide services. Often our victims and witnesses need assistance, not only related to their crime, but just to the crime they observe, but to other things. And witness victim advocates can assist with that. We have to make sure that our lawyers are culturally competent and are respectful of the witnesses that they meet. And finally, we have to make sure that the courthouses and courtrooms are safe. So there's a lot of collaboration and work that can continue to be done. Much of it is being done already, but we're not there in every jurisdiction.
Some people think that one of the main drivers of mass incarceration in recent decades has been prosecutorial zeal, that prosecutors began bringing cases against a greater number of people than in the past. If that's true, how do you go about addressing that?
I haven't studied this particular point. I do know that prosecutors simply enforce laws that have been passed by the legislature. So one would have to look at the legislature first to see who it was that authorized these sentences, because prosecutors don't create the sentences. They simply fulfill the requirements of the law. So there are questions just fundamentally about what does the law require with regard to those sentences. But aside from that, I think there is a growing awareness amongst prosecutors about this issue, a sensitivity to it, a willingness to do far more diversion, deflection, treatment, restorative justice, and as I mentioned before, so many different approaches to avoid the knee-jerk reaction of sending people to jail and prison, which we know is not the right answer in every case.
Christine, we have time for just one more question. You mentioned that there is a lot of innovation going on among prosecutors. What are some examples you can give of new and innovative programs or practices that prosecutors are identifying?
Well, in addition
or, I'm not
to
say
the,
identifying, putting yeah, into
or,
place.
Yeah, or doing. We've seen a tremendous innovation going on in many different ways. One is, in addition to the diversion, restorative justice, and those kinds of things that I just mentioned, but other types of things are collaborations with schools to work with children. One program that I really think is very helpful is prosecutors in a number of places, and I think Eric Zond has this in Platte County, where the prosecutor and the police work with the schools to notify them if a child has had a traumatic event the day before. So, for example, if there was a domestic violence incident in a home and one of the parents was arrested, the police and the prosecutor will notify the school. So when the child comes to school the next day, they're ready, and they know that this child needs some support. That is far outside of the realm of just prosecution, but I think that's an important sensitivity that prosecutors are bringing to the table.
Well, Christine, I'm so sorry to jump in here, but we are running out of time.
Thank you so
much for being here. I've been speaking to Christine Hammond, founder and executive director of the Prosecutors Center for Excellence.
It's the 420 Drug War News. This is a continuation of my discussion with Anthony Lowenstein, author of a brand new book, Pills, Powder, and Smoke, Inside the Bloody War on Drugs.
I want to give a brief description of the book to the listener out there. You traveled the globe. You have been to Honduras, Guinea-Bissau, to the Philippines, to Great Britain, of course, to Australia and other locations, I'm sure, to dig deep, to delve into this, to find out the heart of the matter and how it's all working or, I don't know, implementing itself in these various countries. And I'm going to read a couple of quotes from your book as we go along here. This is on your introduction. It's talking about El Chapo was found guilty of 10 charges against him, and the United States Attorney for the District of New York claimed that the decision was a victory for the 100,000 dead in Mexico and for the drug war itself. He's quoted as saying, "There are those who say the war on drugs is not worth fighting." And he says, those people are wrong. And I say this gentleman is flat out blowing smoke. Your response there, Anthony.
Well, I agree. I mean, I put that in there because I wanted people to see, I guess, readers, that rhetoric, which we've heard for decades, is still very much alive. Not in all people in the government. There are definitely growing voices in elements of the government and law enforcement, in fact, who speak openly about how the drug war is a failure. But there are still people, such as the guy you just mentioned. I don't know him personally, but his quote after the El Chapo trial was instructive, because if anyone believes that by putting El Chapo in prison, and to be clear, El Chapo seems to be a brutal, terrible, murdering thug. I mean, there's no doubt about that. But the truth is that putting him in prison has done literally nothing for drug supply, nothing for drug demand. In fact, his cartel in Mexico, the Sinaloa cartel, is doing very well. Thank you very much. They are transitioning to other drugs. They are now involved in producing fentanyl because the U.S. has a massive demand for fentanyl. So until you legalize and regulate all drugs, which at the moment feels like a long way away, these cartels, who are the ones, they're the ones making the money. It's not the average person who's growing coca in Colombia or some poor drug mule in the US. They're not the ones making money in general. It's the cartels, the criminal groups. They're the ones that people like me who advocate legalization want to shut down. These are not good people. I'm not saying that they are, and they should be gone after. But until you legalize and regulate all drugs, those kind of groups are the ones that are benefiting. So you can lock up El Chapo or many other people like him in the US or elsewhere. At the moment, has had little to zero effect on changing anything to do with the drug war.
I am Dean at DrugTruth.net.
Sitting here in my prime, what am I gonna do now? Am I gonna make it? Some way, somehow. Well, maybe I'm not supposed to know.
We hope you enjoyed today's show and that we leave you with something to think about, something to talk to your neighbors about, and a reason to get involved. As always, the opinions expressed are those of the hosts and guests of Jaws of Justice Radio, not of KKFI, the Midcoast Radio Project Incorporated, its staff, or volunteers. You can find our calendar of events and a link to our show on the Jaws of Justice Radio Facebook page. You can always listen to us live and find our podcasts on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. If you have a show idea or want to help produce the show, email us at jawsofjusticeradio@yahoo.com.
This is Jamie reminding you our outro music is Better Man from the Playing for Change CD. Please tune in for the rest of our 9 a.m. weekday lineup with Law and Disorder on Tuesday, Alternative Radio on Wednesday, Cowtown Conversations on Thursday, and Between the Lines at 9 a.m., followed by Bioneers at 9:30 a.m. on Fridays. Up next is Monday Morning Medicine Show with Dr. Mike, and at noon, Arts Magazine with Michael Hoag. Stick around for jazz and blues in the afternoon.